Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and can also be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. My guest today is John Losey, Concordia College professor of mathematics, chairman of the department there. Our subject today is American education. Is it working, truth or fiction? Meanwhile, the mission of the advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Welcome, John, back to the advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
It's an honor, Richard. Thank you so much.
Thank you also, John. John Losey is a lifelong native of Westchester County, is a professor of math at Concordia College, and served formerly as a professor of math at SUNY Westchester Community College. He's had a long career in academics that spanned decades in both the public and private secondary schools and colleges of Westchester and New York. He's authored over 30 publications, including 8 interdisciplinary books, including The Sigfluence Generation and his latest work, Statistics Made Easy, which was an outgrowth of a National Science Foundation-sponsored program in mathematical modeling that he directed. He's been an active lecturer, and he's been involved in numerous workshops on advanced statistics, mathematical modeling, among other disciplines. He received a unique joint doctorate in math and psychology from Columbia University's Teachers College after being awarded 3 master's degrees in math, counseling, and psychometrics from Manhattan College and Columbia University, followed by a 60-credit program that led to permanent certification as school psychologist from the College of New Rochelle. He's been a member of the following professional organizations: the American Association for Measurement and Evaluation in Counseling and Development, past president of New York State Thought, a consultant editor at Fordham University, a chair there, Task Force on Poverty in New York State, many things, New York Academy of Science, Mathematical Association, New York, Canadian Society for History and Philosophy of Mathematics. It goes on and on, John. I think we're going to run out of time on just your credits. You know, as late as to December 2010, a yearly OECD program for international students assessment is called PISA, P-I-S-A report, which compares the skills and knowledge of 15-year-olds in 70 countries around the world, ranked the United States 14 out of 34 OECD countries for reading skills, 17th for science, and below average 25th for mathematics. This trend has been continuing for many years, as reflected by the 2006 Program for International Student Assessment. Again, that's PISA, showed the U.S. 15-year-olds trailed their peers from many industrialized countries. The average American science score in the U.S. with U.S. students lagged behind those in 16 of 30 countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, a Paris-based group that represents the world's richest countries. The U.S. students were further behind in math, trailing the counterparts. And also, John, just recently, I cut this out of the newspaper the other day, poor test scores spur scrutiny. This is Westchester County, and this is Henry Hudson School, up county. And here, another article from the Associated Press: SAT reading scores lowest on record. Well, John, you've been teaching for over 40 years and have written extensively about the problems of learning. With that in mind, what is at the heart of our education slippage? Why are we on the slippery slope to oblivion?
Well, Richard, for 42 years I've taught, the last 27 years at the college level, and I have 3 brief ideas or anecdotes that might help put this in perspective. At Concordia, years ago, I taught a very gifted young man who I basically guided him in the math team. We tied Cornell and RPI. Concordia got all kinds of kudos, and Chris was the star. Chris was 4.0. And Chris was heading for a PhD in mathematical statistics at either Columbia or Yale. So I got one of my colleagues who worked with me at the National Science Foundation to help him in Calculus 5 and Calculus 9. Yes, there is a Calculus 9. He thrived, got straight A's, and the chair of mathematical statistics at Columbia said it would be nice to have an American student as a PhD student.
Wow.
So this would have been the same at Yale. It would have been nice to have one American at Yale for a PhD in mathematical statistics. Well, God works in mysterious ways, and I lost Chris to become a minister. And thank God it wasn't an English major. No offense, but the ministry you can't quibble with. So there we have Exhibit A. Exhibit B, Alan Greenspan, possibly the most powerful man in Washington over the last three decades. In his autobiography, he claims it isn't Al-Qaeda that's our number one problem. It's our math and science education. I agree. The third idea comes from Richard Rodriguez. When my kids were little, the only way I could get them quiet was when Richard Rodriguez was doing an essay on Channel 13. That was sacrilegious if they spoke when Richard was on the air. Well, Richard was asked last year about all the Hispanics coming into California and overrunning health care and overrunning government. Richard, what can we do with all these Hispanics? And Richard, who has a PhD in literature from Berkeley, who happens to be one of these Hispanics, responded, "We ought to take the third generation Americans who've lost their work ethic and export them back to their country of origin." So, yes, Richard, we have slipped.
Right. You know, paradoxically, America seems to face two innate problems when it comes to education. The first problem is not only the resegregation of more school districts along racial and, of course, economic lines over the years since 1954, which has created more rich and poor districts, and the general decline in the interest in learning, which, again, cuts across all economic and social classes. In other words, many sections of our country, young people deride education and socially stigmatize youngsters who study hard. This is the sense. We have stigmatizing and we have economically, I would say, segregated and socially segregated areas. John, why has this happened? And is this a sociological trend that cannot be explained or even reversed in the short run?
Well, I would recommend to all the listeners to read Robert Reich's recent book, Aftershock. Dr. Reich, who now is at U of Cal Berkeley, says that we have a dramatic, unsustainable divide between rich and poor in the United States. The only time the ratio was this extreme was prior to the Great Depression. We really are digging ourselves into an unsustainable hole because of unfettered greed on Wall Street and in the business sector. The second idea is school budgets for economically disadvantaged kids. I interviewed Superintendent Bernard Perazio over the summer for my latest book. I taught with Bernard. He might be one of the best teachers I've ever taught with, and Yonkers really did well in hiring him as a superintendent. He remodeled Yonkers. He basically brought in pre-K. Kids who had a 40% chance of graduating high school now had a 90% chance of graduating high school. And then a week before our interview, he had to lay off 700 teachers and staff. He said, "John, it's just like when I was little and I built Lego sets and I felt like a big bully came by and just stepped on them and crushed them." So we basically have two Americas. And the one America is over the top in wealth. The bottom part of America is basically unsustainably poor, dangerously poor, and we can't continue having the prison industrial complex as being the only growth industry in America.
And just as a corollary to what you said, it recently came out that the 400 richest Americans own more equity in America than the bottom 150 million. It used to be 5%, 6%, 8%.
It used to be 150,000.
Now it's 400. Meanwhile, America spends, John, as you know, an inordinate amount of money on education at every level from primary school to the graduate school level. Costs here in Westchester, the public school can run to the average of $30,000 per student, and at a middle-level private college could run to $60,000. What are the consequences of this acceleration in spending, and are we reaching a tipping point?
Well, Richard, I visited Harlem, Mount Vernon, and Yonkers. We've gone into the toughest schools at Roosevelt High School and the Bronx. I got lost, but I knew it was a school because it had barbed wire and police officers in front. So we finally recognized the school. Well, anyway, we basically have tipped. We are past the tipping point. If you go into the inner city, you basically see that prison is the norm for inner city black youth. We tipped years ago, and I just like some politician to get up and say, I have a plan to address this. This isn't a decade-old problem. This is now a generation-old problem. It's not getting better. And when the Supreme Court of the United States, and I'm not a historian, but I can't imagine a more conservative Supreme Court says that California prisons are unconstitutional. If this isn't a, if we have, this is not a tipping point, right. We've tipped.
Well, interestingly enough, this actually is the most conservative court. And if you compare this court to the Roosevelt, the pre-New Deal court with the four horsemen of the apocalypse, supposedly the most conservative judge, these judges are much more conservative. Mm-hmm. And some of the ones that have left for one reason or another have been up there. I think the statistics show the out of the top 10 most conservative justices in history, most of them are on this. You know, in our closing moment in this segment, you recommend Jonathan Kozol's Savage Inequality, which describes how to understand the turmoil of day-to-day teaching in an economically disadvantaged school. And you, after teaching in a savage inequality school, you taught math at Horace Mann, an elite private school, which I spent some time in, and high school math in middle class Saunders High School in Yonkers. Are the savage inequality schools taking over?
Well, we only visited economically disadvantaged high schools in the Bronx, in Harlem, and Yonkers. And the reason we went into these savage inequality schools was that these kids, the success stories now, the 70% of these kids who graduate go to college. It is shocking that mathematics at college becomes an insurmountable barrier for these kids to graduate college. The remedial services at college are so woefully inadequate to stem this tide of poverty that the 8-year graduation rate of a remedial youngster, typically an economically disadvantaged kid, is 19%. Now, forget 4 years. We don't even have a 4-year graduation rate. We give them 8 years. Mm. 8 years, and we have an 81% failure rate. And this is of our success stories. Mm. So, yes, the savage inequality schools are sadly rampant. And if anything, things are getting worse.
Right. You know, this is Richard J. Garfunkel. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM radio and live streaming on WVOX.com. I'm talking to Professor John Losey of Concordia College about American education and where it's going or where it's been, or maybe it's not going anywhere. Professor John Losey first appeared on The Advocates in January 2010. Our discussion was his book, The Sigfluence Generation. As I asked you then, what is Sigfluence and why did you create that term? And in the last 20 months, has there been more feedback regarding your concept?
Well, 27 years ago, I spoke at Harvard and I gave a paper on Sigfluence, which I defined as significant, long-term, positive influence. The listeners can go to my website, www.sigfluence.com, download my 8th book for free, and read my weekly blog, and I value their comments. Now, the reason that I came up with this word is I think Sigfluence is widely neglected in psychology. I have a master's in counseling psych, half of my doctorate is in psychological measurement, I have a 60-credit postdoctoral certification as a psychologist. Sigfluence is not there. It's not in education. It's not in politics. And most alarmingly, it isn't a construct that we think about in terms of our personal life. And yes, there has been more feedback regarding Sigfluence lately. I basically got an email from Biz India that has 390,000 hits. And the publisher and head of Biz India reviewed my book, and I just said, wow, I can't, this is really very positive. So again, things are happening. But you were first, Richard, last year when you had me on this show, and things are happening.
You know, it's interesting, and speaking about where we're going, America in the second decade of the 21st century faces many new and unique problems. It's been said that America, with its free and primary and secondary education system, state and city-sponsored colleges, and vast access to scholarships, made quantum leaps over its international competitors who skewed their educational opportunities to the rich and the most talented. After World War II, we benefited by an innovative GI Bill program. Should we create a new GI Bill that could not just focus on the limited amount of service men and women we have today, but on young people who could volunteer for 2 years or 3 years of national service with something like AmeriCorps or a clone of that?
This is a great idea. Richard, this is an idea that is influential. If we can get one inner-city youngster into a service corps who isn't there now, and as a result, they go to college and it's funded, this is Sigfluence. Now, I thought about this idea. I gave it a lot of thought. I called AmeriCorps, and basically there is structure there to basically innovate your idea. Now, I figured out that we could reach 1 million inner-city black and Hispanic males, $20,000 per student, for $20 billion. Richard, $20 billion is chump change in terms of the numbers they're throwing around in Congress. Mm. This could help 1 million poor kids. Now, my recent book basically deals with the lies in education. And one lie is that religion and education don't mix. Well, I think religion and education have to mix. And I think this is the 21st century now. We have to go beyond love of neighbor, which is basically the expressed spiritual definition of religion within Christianity, within Islam, within Judaism, to basically actually doing things. Now, what I suggest is that your idea in Judaism is repairing the world. This is a central concept of Judaism. So Jews have to take ownership here. In Christianity, in James, in the Bible, we're instructed to be doers of the word, not hearers only. In Islam, Ibu Patel over in Chicago has over 1 million followers. He's a visionary leader who basically wants Christianity and Islam to unite rather than divide, according to the deleterious and dangerous divide that exists in America today. In Buddhism, the Dalai Lama meditates for 3 hours every morning so he can be of optimal service to the people within his domain. So love of neighbor has to go beyond tolerance to actually getting out there and doing something. And Richard, this is a transformational idea. And I hope everyone supports you, writes letters to you, the congressman, to do something about these neglected and abandoned inner city youth.
Well, they are the future, and we can see the future ahead of us. If we took the 75 million baby boomers and the 25 million people who were older than baby boomers out of the total number of 320 Americans, the profile of the balance of 220 million Americans would be much, much different.
Yes.
And interestingly, these young people have to support these 100 million baby boomers and pre-baby boomers far into the 21st century because people are living longer. And I'm not so sure they're living healthily longer, but they're living longer. You know, and this is a critical thing. So we have to get these people on board. You know, not long ago, we heard the media refer to Generation Y, a description regarding our 18 to 25-year-olds and their coming impact. Today, the term is rarely heard. Many of these people are unemployed, part of the new anxiety generation. You spend a great deal of time in the classroom with many of these young people who've graduated high school in the midst of our greatest recession since the 1930s. What are they talking about, and what are their concerns? And are they becoming more conscientious students, knowing that this is a big investment by their parents and their own selves?
Well, Richard, we did a 3-year study several years ago, and we looked at 542 students from Concordia College and Iona College. And we looked at marketing variables like money, credit cards, number of cars in a driveway, parents' education, and Sigfluence variables, like I want to help others. Well, anyway, what I found looking at 10,000 correlations after it took my two graduate students, Grace and Teresa, 18 months to enter the data, was that the potential for Sigfluence was the best predictor of living a satisfying life, closely followed by the need to effect Sigfluence. So I call this generation the Sigfluence generation. They have a high need to effect Sigfluence. They report a high potential to effect Sigfluence, but they don't have a clue how to effect Sigfluence. So they need mentorship from us in terms of our successes and our failures. And I don't think it's any accident that Egypt and Libya basically had a transformation, and it was the 18 to 25-year-olds who transformed the political system of Egypt and Libya. We need these same 18 to 25-year-olds to make concrete progress in terms of the divide in America and our abandonment of the poor.
Well, part of the anxiety generation could be articulated as the no-hope generation. Certainly in Libya and Egypt was reflective of that. A lot of children from eras of prosperity, you know, oil monies, different things. If you look into third world countries, the very large percentage of population is young people. Why?
Yes.
Young people to these people were wealth. Now they face no hope. So in the no hope generation, they have to go forward to actuate change. But interesting, I want to comment before our break here, as you said, love of neighbor. Also, I think you should include in that parable, if you want to say that, is love of self. That self-hating people have a tendency to be nihilistic and destructive. So not only, in a sense, as Hillel said, if I'm not for me, who is for me? It didn't mean to be selfish, but it meant take care of your own. If you take care of yourself and you can pull your own oar, right? I'm all right, Jack. That has a tendency to be infectious, too. Then you have time, once you've pulled your own oar, once you're on a stable footing, to go to that neighbor, almost like lend-lease and lend him the hose to put out the fire. You know what I mean? In a sense.
This is a very profound point, Richard. And one of my students was from Nepal, and he wanted to go back to Nepal with an associate's degree. And I said, go back to Nepal with a PhD from Columbia in biostatistics and transform Nepal. Carl Jung, the visionary psychologist, said, the most that we can do for the world is to develop ourselves. And that's true. I tell my students to be selfish, to get two master's degrees, and then synergize these master's degrees and serve others.
Right.
And you make money. And everyone lives happily ever after. Yes, your first responsibility, you're not much help to somebody else if you're a high school dropout.
Right. Exactly. You know, I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is John Losey. I've been taught professor of mathematics at Concordia College, head of the math department. We're talking about education in America, where it's going, and that's combined with self and self-image and self-love. I mean, let's face it, education, it goes hand in hand with a civilized society. In the same way Oliver Wendell Holmes said, paying taxes is the price of civilization, and education doesn't come cheaply.
Yes.
At Concordia College, where you teach and you've been for many years, you and your colleagues feature a 90% success rate in math, which is quite unusual comparatively to almost everywhere else. What's the key to your success, John?
Well, we have absolutely wonderful professors who are students-centered. The average professor has about 35 years on the job, and it takes 10 years to be an effective teacher. I mean, Jeffrey Canada claims that he was a master teacher in 2 years. Jeffrey, I don't believe it. Now, the next idea is the least you need to know. The least you need to know means that we're not going to basically teach the simplex method in college algebra. There are things like the simplex method that should be banned as unconstitutional, and yet colleges somehow teach this, and as a result, they cut down their graduation rate by 52%. So the idea is to serve the student and every student can succeed in statistics. So we basically have statistics as the minimum requirement for graduation. But if a student has talent, we push them, we cajole them, we beg them, we bludgeon them into taking Calculus 1, Calculus 2, and above, where their professional prospects are unlimited because of how few people are willing to put in 6 hours a week homework on a single course, namely Calculus and above.
You know, you extended this effort at the senior high school level at Riverside High in Yonkers, New York, an economically disadvantaged high school. What was the result of your efforts, and what happened when you approached other schools in the region?
Well, I guess honesty is the best policy, Richard.
That's what they say.
And we gave seminars, an hour and 20-minute seminar, to 1,200 students in Harlem and Yonkers, where 99% of the students gave us rave reviews. Any listener who wants to read 1,000 evaluations, come to my office. They're on the floor. Now, one would think that something so important as to counsel these young people in terms of getting serious would be widely embraced. Well, no. Last year, we didn't get into a single school, even schools that we had gone to, and got in these rave reviews. I don't understand why it's so difficult to do good in this world. But Riverside High School is a beacon of hope. I was in despair last year, bicycling on the Croton Aqueduct Trail. It was filled with mud, so I had to get on the streets. And 10 minutes later, I passed this gorgeous, stunning school, Riverside High School. Donald Trump would have used this for his next Taj Mahal if we had gambling in New York State in terms of the location. With bike helmet in hand, I went in and described what I could offer Riverside High School. Carol Bayoko, after 30 seconds, the assistant principal sensed that I wasn't crazy or even highly eccentric. With open arms, we gave a scintillating seminar for the 11th grade, with Joe Farmer coming down from East Ramapo, the ex-superintendent of schools, and he's charismatic. And we had three of our charismatic students speak, and Professor Butts and I aren't bad. And it was just so wonderful that we innovated last spring college statistics. We had 9 students, and all got a C or better. So for these 9 students, their college graduation rate was doubled. And in the fall, 50 seem to have signed up. And in the spring, it looks like we're going to get a healthy number of students. So, Richard, we have 100 students who might be benefiting from this innovation. We have about 10 million to go.
No doubt about it. You know, the schools that fail with their students married to antiquated systems that don't address the realities and new challenges, what are we to do with these schools? Are they going to just be more just closed down, or are they just going to keep on going along with failure as their model?
Well, Richard, as long as the failure is consistent and we basically want to maintain the status quo, there's little incentive to dramatically change the status quo. If we change the status quo instead of a 9.2% unemployment rate, that may be an 11.2% unemployment rate. So there's a sad, insidious denial of reality that perpetuates the sad system. Now, at Riverside High School, they immediately came over to what I think is a sensible approach to teaching mathematics. By senior year, the student either takes statistics so he or she can make better personal and professional decisions, and or calculus. And then in college, you go as high as you can mathematically speaking. I had 3 students who took the advanced math at Concordia with me and followed everything that I suggested. They visited me last week. Pierre Juan is graduating Columbia. He's going to escort the president of Korea around New York City next month when he comes into town. Suni is basically going on for his master's PhD, and he's going to go back to his nation to transform the nation. Haram is an accountant studying for CPA so he can make lots of money and give his parents the money for mission for Korean immigrants. So math is power. Math is the key to transforming the globe. The Chinese get it. They enter about 1,000 teams in an international contest in mathematical modeling. We enter 1,000 teams. The rest of the world, 5%. China and the U.S. are there in terms of advanced math, which is absolutely essential for a transformation.
Yeah. You know, I have your book here, Statistics Made Easy, in front of me. And within its 200 pages, it includes so many of the essential mathematical needs that face our public, like simple and compound interest, annuities, elementary probability, among others. How come you were able to synthesize math made easy within 200 pages, wherein high schools and colleges need thousands of pages and years of repetitive courses and teaching to make an impact?
Well, Richard, I've come to the conclusion that we just can't give students wasted courses like history of mathematics, like mathematical explorations. I mean, we have to go in two different tracks. We have to get the basics down. Everyone needs fractions, decimals, percentage, which is should be mastered by fifth or sixth grade. But by the time students graduate high school, they should have statistics to help them with their personal life and their decisions, or be on the calculus track, Calc 1, Calc 2, Calc 3, and beyond. What I did was, after I finished my book on statistical modeling for the elite graduate students in math, I said, let me write something for the weaker students, because mathematical modeling is applied mathematics to transform the world in terms of, for example, terrorism, in terms of oil depletion, in terms of the global warming. This is all mathematical modeling. Hurricane Irene prediction was all mathematical modeling. But that's for the elite of the elite. You don't even start that until you have three semesters of calculus, calculus-based probability, calculus-based statistics. So 90% of the world is not going there. But 90% of the world needs statistics, and they need a clear statistics explanation. Now, we had 700-page books that we assigned to our students in statistics. And my first year teaching, I buried the students with formulas. And then it dawned on me, if I, as a researcher, where I've consulted for Baruch, I've consulted for legal cases, I've consulted for curriculum, I've consulted for Department of Transportation, if I've never used a topic, could I delete it sensibly so I could go slower and focus on the pith of statistics where every topic helps the students? And it's amazing what you can cut away once you actually know what's important. You go slower and you apply the mathematics to the student's life. That's statistics. That's power.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. And before our next segment break, the students are thought of possibly, and I think pejoratively, as lazy. But aren't there too many distractions in our society that parents are not helping their children cope with? We seem to be of a society of bread and circus, material and celebrity. Isn't this time for the parents to step up and start making discerning decisions with raising their children in a way to have them focus more on the rest of their life, on building a foundation for the rest of their life?
Distracted is here to stay, unfortunately. There was a book by an author, I forget her name, but the entire faculty read this book, and we were really distressed by the degree of distraction, which was even greater than we thought possible. And what makes me particularly sad is we started a book club at my church, Union Church, where I'm going to lead the discussion on Moby Dick that's going to go on for 6 months. Then my co-partner, John Berkeley, is going to lead the discussion on Ulysses, which will probably go on for a year. So we're going to spend 18 months on two books. Now, I'm not sure if our students are willing to spend 18 minutes to actually read 10 pages thoughtfully. Right. So it is a great divide. But Richard, on the other side of the coin, and I'm saying this with my son, he's distracted, but there's a Palme d'Or film called The Barbarian Invasion that basically looks at these young people and the U of Cal Berkeley professor in the hospital bed introduces to the nurse his son, and he says, "This is my son. He's making millions on Wall Street. He's proud that he has never read a book in his life." Hmm. So it's complex.
Right. You know, I want to remind our audience that you are listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest, Professor John Losey of Concordia College. We're talking about education, America, and where it's going. You know, in the beginning of your new book regarding President Obama's position on American education, you quote Dostoevsky's Demons. And I quote, "My friend, I've been lying all my life. The most difficult thing in life is to live and not lie and not believe one's own lies." I mean, we have a tendency. And as I've said before, I say to my children, don't lie to the person in the mirror. What did you mean by that quote? And what is your analysis of President Obama's educational goals?
Well, I'm a supporter of President Obama. I think that I informally debated with Michael Dukakis at Harvard 15 years ago when he said, "How come we're the only major industrialized nation in the world without health care?" And the professor from Stanford and professor from Harvard were so inadequate to debate Michael Dukakis that I raised my hand and I said, "It's because the American people want to live with the illusion that they're good and noble, and they don't want to see the millions of poor people dying at age 30 in the streets because of preventable illness." Well, anyway, I was outraged when President Obama said that his goal is to become number one in the world in college graduation rates by 2020. President Obama is influenced by Moby Dick. He's influenced by Shakespeare. I thought that he basically was pure. But once he said something that is so outrageously false that even the obsequious cabinet secretary, Duncan, said, "I don't think this is attainable." I have never heard a secretary in the cabinet say that a president's goal is unattainable before. So that tells you something. Yeah, well, so it's outrageous. The high school dropout rate, the college dropout rate, the demographics in terms of our population, the divide between rich and poor, the inadequate money for people to go to college if you're poor, the two-class society the school budgets in Yonkers, you're going to have more dropouts in Yonkers because 700 people were let go. I hope some were restored, but it's so outrageous that it fueled the book, the lies. And President Obama is enabling 300 million people to lie. We're in denial.
Right. You know, you quote Mark Twain, who said, "They're lies, damn lies, and statistics." And you know what they say, liars quote statistics and statistics lie. You know, he popularized this phrase, attributing to the 19th century British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli. We need Mark Twain to do justice to characterizing President Obama's, I'll call it, white lie, little white lie, took place on August 2010 when he spoke at the University of Texas. Quickly, could you list them?
Well, sure. America can become the world leader in college graduation rates by 2020, lie one. Lie two, the purpose of American education is to educate, lie three. There exist omniscient supervisors who can validly and reliably evaluate and rank teachers, lie four. Our 18 to 25-year-olds are self-absorbed narcissists, lie five. To raise graduation rates, we must lower standards, lie six. Get a good education, then you get a good job. Lie 7. Education, values, and religion do not mix. Lie 8. Poor parents do not care about their children's education. Lie 9. We can do nothing to transform education.
Well, it's interesting, and, you know, of course, we know that many of these things can be done. But are these lies or is this rhetoric typical of presidents to create ideals we should strive for? Going to the moon, George Bush, number 1,000 points of light, Reagan's shining house on the hill. Isn't this sort of, in our closing moments, a kind of setting a goal that we may not get there? I mean, our last president wanted to go to Mars, as I figured, and many people wanted to send him there. On the taxpayers' ticket would have done that. But isn't this part of this, idealism? Because when the president, like him or lump him, Jimmy Carter, and I certainly don't like them, spoke in front of a fireplace with a sweater and told people we got tough times coming with claws. People said, how dare you say that? Isn't that so?
Well, I went to Random House, the Unabridged Dictionary, and I looked up lie to get a precise definition of lie. And the second definition is something intended or serving a false impression. Well, this is the epitome of serving a false impression. We're 24th in the world in math and sinking, and somehow we're going to get to number one. If that isn't a lie by that definition, I can't imagine a better example. Then the third definition of lie is an inaccurate or false statement. Well, it is inaccurate, and it is false.
Well, this is one of the problems we face, and obviously our political system, right, left, center, is spawning all sorts of statements like Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. You know, we've heard that before, but tell it to the millions and tens of millions who kept the wolf away from the door, correct? You know, in our final moments, the struggle seems to be an uphill battle which may never be won before the system collapses. Professor Mark Taylor at Columbia University has written in his book, Crisis on Campus, he was on this show a number of months ago, that our university system is at the verge of tipping. What are your recommendations? We have a minute or two left. Is there some simple manners that we could actually incorporate, God forbid use the word planning, we could incorporate that could probably bring the bottom up without compromising the top?
Three ideas. Costs. Support TRIO at Westchester Community College. Dr. Joseph Hankin, one of the top leaders in education in the country, said that TRIO brings 90% of the economically disadvantaged kids back to campus. It's an unbelievable number. Keep TRIO. Bernard Parazio. Support Bernard Parazio in economically disadvantaged school districts. Vote for the school budget to be passed. Bernard wants these kids to graduate. Otherwise, we just have a prison industrial complex. Curriculum. College professors, prune your curriculum. Get rid of the simplex method. Get rid of algebraic fractions and the quadratic equation for college algebra remediation. Teach the least you need to know to get these kids successful. Standards. And this is a beautiful way to close, Richard. 25 years ago, my mentor, the beloved late Richard Wolff at Columbia, gave me the Griggs decision to read. He said, John, read this decision. It reads like great literature. Well, anyway, the Griggs decision by the Supreme Court said that you cannot introduce a standard, a test, without testing the test's validity in some sense. You just can't throw a test there and basically say that because you got an 80 on a calculus test that you can be a fireman. Well, anyway, I was inspired by the Griggs decision, and much of my work has been in covert bias and testing the validity of professional credentials. Well, anyway, 20 years later, the Ward's Cove decision pretty much cut the legs out from Griggs in terms of interpreting or to mean and. Only a logician basically uses that kind of trick. But instead of the plaintiff having several criteria for suit, there had to be multiple criteria, so Clarence Thomas went from 100,000 complaints to a trickle as a result of Ward's Cove. Well, 20 years later, we're even more conservative than Ward's Cove and more restrictive, so the poor have even less of a chance to change the system. Sake Fluence Generation, go to Harvard Law, go to Yale Law, do your clerking, and get on the Supreme Court. All I'm asking, it's not conservative, it's not liberal, it's just fairness. We have to go beyond face validity to have somebody test whether our criteria are fair to optimize human potential.
Well, there's no question that we're going to get what we deserve, and down the line there will be a new generation, like it or lump it, that will take over, and we better be careful that the new generation has a half a brain and a part of an education. I want to thank you, John Losey, Professor John Losey of Concordia. I want to wish You good luck with your classes at Concordia College, as we look forward to almost your next book on education. But hopefully, we're going to move forward and get some things done in the here and now. You know, if you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where my information on my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be hosting Tom Nesse, the author of Poison Pills, The Story of Vioxx. We'll be talking about drugs, prescriptions, and how they affect the current state of American healthcare. Thank you again, John, for joining us here today on The Advocates.
Always a pleasure, and I consider it a privilege. And please follow Richard Garfunkel's suggestion there. I'm not taking credit for it, only that I believe that this is a transformational idea he has developed.
Very good show, John.
Oh, that was...